afternoon, and welcome to the Eco-News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Eco-News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco-News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Managing for the protection and recovery of threatened and endangered species is, at best, a complicated task. That's especially true because even though we know that the loss of habitat and declining reproduction put species on the road to extinction, we don't yet have a clear understanding of how many imperiled species respond to various stresses that can affect their ability to thrive and reproduce. In some cases, we're not even sure we can find the species when they're present. Even in the case of the northern spotted owl, one of the most studied threatened species on the planet, the relatively recent invasion of the barred owl, a larger cousin of the northern spotted owl, has left researchers and managers scrambling to develop new survey protocols. Where once finding spotted owls was relatively straightforward, go to suitable habitat and make or play an owl call, and in many cases an owl would show up in short order. Today, where barred owls are present, spotted owls will often stay silent. In the real world, imperiled species often face multiple sources of stress. For example, spotted owls face not only barred owls, but also great horned owls, as well as various kinds of human disturbance. Figuring out how owls respond to these multiple stresses could be immensely valuable to land managers and wildlife agencies, but it's often very difficult to study even a relatively large and tractable species like the northern spotted owl in the wild. Recently, however, scientists with the University of Washington's Center for Conservation Biology have come up with a fascinating way to get some very interesting data on barred owls, northern spotted owls, and how the northern spotted owl responds to various kinds of stresses. Their breakthrough technique? They've trained dogs to find owl scat, and even to identify not only which species the scat comes from, but which animal. My guests today are two of the scientists who've led this research with the University of Washington's Center for Conservation Biology. Dr. Samuel Wasser is a pioneer in the development of non-invasive wildlife monitoring methods and indeed of the field of conservation endocrinology. Dr. Wasser holds the University of Washington's Endowed Chair in Conservation Biology. Dr. Lisa Hayward worked with the Center for Conservation Biology as a postdoctoral fellow in the research that we'll be discussing today. She's now undertaking a policy fellowship with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Welcome to the Eco-News Report, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So where did this idea of using dogs to study imperiled species get started?
Well, in the mid-1980s, my lab developed methods of measuring a variety of hormones from species of wildlife and applying it to a number of conservation and ecology questions. And eventually, we developed ways also to measure DNA in the samples. And we were really trying to address a problem where many conservation issues are really in need of being addressed over very, very large landscapes, and a lot of the work had really focused on small areas and extrapolated accordingly. And also, there was an added problem that very rarely does one disturbance occur in isolation. When there's one, there's many. And so to address that, we wanted to be able to get a wide variety of physiological and genetic measures from animals and get them relatively easy over very large landscapes. And the scat was the ideal vehicle because there's nothing more available from animals than their scat. And what happened was around the mid-90s, I was at a conference in Washington State where they had just banned hound hunting for cougar and for bears. And what happened was the hound hunters were at the meeting talking about their dogs and how their livelihood has been ruined. And I thought, oh my God, I could use these dogs to find scat. So I went and met with the dog handler afterwards, and he quickly said, you don't really want one of our dogs. They're tracking dogs. What you really want is an air scent dog, a dog that keeps its head up in the air and smells the difference, the strength of the current of the scent cone in the air, as opposed to a tracking dog that keeps his nose on the ground and smelling rats of skin. He said, you really need a drug dog. And so we contacted some people doing training. All of the narcotics dogs in the Pacific Northwest started to work the system, and we were absolutely flabbergasted how good it worked.
Fascinating. So we should note that these owl studies are just a small piece of your overall work with the canine conservation. You've used conservation dogs to study a number of species around the world now.
Yes, that's quite true. And our dogs really work all over the world. We have studied things as diverse as tigers in Cambodia, jaguar, cougar, Maine wolf, giant anteater and giant armadillo in Brazil, grizzly bears in Alberta, Canada, and Montana, caribou, wolf, and moose in Alberta, killer whales. We have dogs ride on the bow of a boat and are able to detect killer whale scat floating over a mile away in the water. Pacific fisher, just a wide variety of species, even pocket mice, which are about the size of a golf ball, whose fecal sample is about the size of a sesame seed, and our dogs are able to locate those as well. So they're quite effective. And of course, with the spotted owls, the dogs are trained on this scat, but there we also train them on the pellets, because we're especially interested in finding their roost, and when they're sitting in their roost regurgitating the pellets, that's an ideal signal for locating the roost.
Just explain a little bit further what the pellet is for an owl.
Well, when an owl eats prey like a flying squirrel or a wood rat, essentially they pretty much choke it all down, and the pellet then consists largely of hair and bone primarily, and claws that the animal can't digest that well and regurgitates that back out.
But even with that, you're going to be able to get a small sample of the predator animal's DNA as well as the prey animal?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It doesn't take very much DNA at all to be able to amplify with all the new methods, because what you do is you amplify it up to maybe a million or more products of just the strand of DNA you're interested in this case, the host DNA, and then you can amplify it. Once you've amplified it, you run it out on a genetic analyzer, and you can see by the size of the DNA fragment you amplified whether or not it's a spotted owl or a barred owl or some other owl.
So your work first came to my attention with the paper you guys co-authored last year, Detection Dogs Provide an Alternate Survey Method for Spotted Owls. So first off, why do we need an alternate method?
Well, it's an interesting situation. Many of your listeners will know the impact that northern spotted owls had on the Endangered Species Act. They were listed as threatened under the act in 1990 because of widespread population decline, mainly due to habitat destruction from logging. And then what happened was there was a considerable politic when Judge William Dwyer issued an injunction against federal timber sales in the West Coast in 91, and that really just led to a whole firestorm of activity. It even resulted in President Clinton and Al Gore to come to the Pacific Northwest for the Northwest Forest Summit in Portland, and all that led to the Northwest Forest Plan in 1994, which was really a science-based method to figure out how best to manage and restore old-growth forests so that you promote conservation of the northern spotted owl. Well, one of the factors that trigger the Northwest Forest Plan in particular areas is the establishment of occupancy of owls. If there are no owls there, then the rules are not as strict. And the way that they establish occupancy is through vocal surveys. So literally, people go to designated areas in suspected home ranges or in good owl habitat and give a four-note hoot that simulates the breeding call of the owl. And typically, it's the male that will respond, and especially early in the breeding season. And once they have that, then they will go in on the owl. Often, they'll bring a mouse with them so that the owl will fly and grab the mouse and then take it to their young if they have it, so they can actually look at, who's, is it a nest pair, do they have young, etc. So all this was really important tools for years, but then around the same time, the barred owl was expanding its range from eastern United States, also because logging was making habitat more suitable for the barred owl, and it was moving westward, and pretty soon the barred owl, which is the same genus as the spotted owl, but twice as big, and is a competitor and sometimes even a predator of the owl, started causing a lot of trouble for the owl, taking over their, occupying their territories and excluding the spotted owl. And then what happened was when people were going and using the hooting surveys, vocal surveys, to locate the spotted owl, if there was a barred owl present on the territory, oftentimes the spotted owl wouldn't respond, because if it did respond, the barred owl would know where it is and might come in and attack it. So here you had this really unique problem where pretty sophisticated conservation management rules were put into place that were triggered by vocalization surveys, and then another species comes in that threatens the spotted owl, adds to the problem, and at the same time essentially derails the whole vocalization survey method. It still works sometimes, but it's not nearly as effective as it used to be.
And I guess one of the serious problems with the older survey methods is the risk of a false negative, that you can go out and survey and survey and survey, and there can be an owl there, but it won't necessarily respond.
Yes, exactly. And you know, the areas where it needs the most protection are areas that are starting to get disturbed, and those are places where the barred owl is more likely to invade and more likely to get a false negative. And then, of course, you also have the problem of putting the spotted owl at direct risk. I mean, you know, there have been cases noted where the spotted owl responds and a barred owl just comes in and whacks the spotted owl.
So how did the dogs do? Were they able to find spotted owls, barred owls?
They did phenomenally well. They did, in fact, way better than we ever dreamed. One of the challenges with doing this kind of work, which is different from following many other species where terrestrial mammals are moving around, depending on the species you're covering, they may be defecating all over the landscape, so you have lots of places to locate animals. But when you're trying to find the roost sites of owls, it's a bit more like trying to find a needle in a haystack. And so what we did was we took these habitat utilization models by two different investigators, Zabel and colleagues and Carlos Carroll. Both of them had developed very good habitat models for spotted owls that had a very good ability to predict areas where a roost was maximally likely to occur. And so we would develop, using those models, find within historic ranges. So a historic range was the place that owls have been noted or heard within the last, 15 years, Lisa?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but we didn't know if there were owls there at the time. And then the search area was defined by these habitat models, looking for a 2 square kilometer area, and then the dogs would search that area to find samples. And at the same time, we had 2 experienced owl vocal survey teams that actually went and got formal training from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service using their 2010 protocol. So the 2 vocal survey teams would go and survey the same areas that our 2 dog teams would work, and then we compared the 2 over this 2-month study period, roughly. And the first visit to a site, there was an average of about a 37% detection probability of the vocal surveys. And they have to do at least 6 visits and 7 days apart, I think. And by the 5th visit, they had detected owls in 82% of all the sites they had visited, and they never got any higher than 82%. Our dogs were at 77% the first time, compared to 32% for the vocal. And by the 2nd visit to the same area, they already had detected owls in 94% of these historic sites. And by the 3rd, they were up to 100%. So what that means is that by the 2nd visit, we were already much higher in our probability of detecting an owl than the vocal surveys ever got.
That's phenomenal. So what other advantages are there to using detection dogs beyond just their efficacy?
Well, for one thing, you don't put the owl at risk. And the other thing is that they can simultaneously locate barred owls. So when there are barred owls on the spotted owls range, you can be detecting them simultaneously. And it's especially valuable when these barred owls are just arriving, because they may be more reluctant to respond to hooting surveys because they haven't really established their territory. When these animals first come in and they're just checking out the area, they're not so keen to let others know that they're in the area, because that may affect their ability to establish a territory. So once they come in and get comfortable in the area, they're more likely to respond. So by being able to detect both spotted owls and barred owls at the same time, you not only can get a better understanding of spotted owl occupancy, but you can also get a good idea of the competition that they're facing and how quickly it's changing over time. So that's, for this particular system, it's very useful. As time goes on, if you were really going to use this to study both spotted owls and barred owls at the same time, then we would move towards using actual habitat models for both spotted owls and barred owls to give them both an equal chance. Right now, for this particular method in this level of study, we just use the habitat maps for spotted owls in this first work.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the EcoNews Report on KHSU. I'm Scott Greeson, Executive Director of EPIC. I'm talking on the phone with Drs. Samuel Wasser and Lisa Hayward, both from the University of Washington Center for Conservation Biology. We're talking about some absolutely fascinating research into spotted owls and their responses to various kinds of stress, as well as efforts to detect them using dogs. So let's move on to the question of conservation endocrinology, which you've used to great effect in your new paper, which looks at the effects of vehicle noise on owls. How on earth do you do this?
Well, we did two things. We were mostly interested in how the effects of the motorcycles impacted the survival and the reproductive success of the owls. So we did a correlational approach to track that through the season, looking at the number of young they produced and comparing that to their proximity to roads and the level of traffic on those roads. And then we also wanted to link the effects directly to the motorcycle exposure itself. So we applied an experimental design that involved an hour-long exposure where volunteers from the local community would come and ride their motorcycles exactly as they would during a competitive event in the forest. And we would collect the scat produced by the owl, so the feces, before, during, and after those experimental motorcycle exposures. And then we collected the scat exactly the same way on a whole set of matched control sites where everything was the same, but we had no motorcycle exposure. And then we took all that scat back to the lab, and we were able to measure hormone metabolites. And those hormone metabolites told us how much ferritin was in the circulation of the owl before and after the experiment, and also how much thyroid hormone was there. And the stress steroids are part of a generalized response to a number of disturbances, so they'll vary with nutritional status, they'll vary with challenge from predators, or human disturbance, weather, a lot of different environmental factors, and then the thyroid hormones are specifically tied to the nutritional status of the owls. So by looking at both, we were able to tell which stresses were specific to food availability and which were more general to the environment. And by looking at them in relation to our experimental design, we were able to assign a certain level of disturbance specifically to the motorcycle exposure that we applied. And then by putting that together with the correlational component, we were able to conclude pretty definitively that the stress from the motorcycles is having a very negative impact on the owls through the course of the season, on the actual number of young they can produce.
That's a pretty striking result, given what we've known previous to this study. How far does an owl need to be from the motorcycle stress to show the impact of the noise?
We actually were surprised to find that the impacts didn't diminish noticeably with the distance from road within a range of 800 meters. So we know from acoustical work that the sound attenuates almost completely at that level, 800 meters from the road. But for some reason, the owls are still responding to it when we have them roosting 800 meters from the road. So it might just be that they're aware of activity. There's something about the motorcycles on the road that's actually disturbing them to a level that's pretty comparable, even though they're a ways off the road. And that's just when we look at their acute stress response. So if you look at the impacts on the reproductive success, those drop off the further they get. And we see that that's kind of a dose response effect, where the further you get from the road, the less the impacts on reproductive success.
But you said you got a fairly straightforward result in terms of owls that nest closer to roads reproduce more poorly.
Yeah, when those roads are busy roads.
Right.
Ironically, they do better when the roads are quiet roads. So when there are roads that aren't used regularly by traffic, the owls actually benefit. And we know by looking at the thyroid hormone that they're eating better near those quiet roads. And so we think that having a road that's not used regularly must have some beneficial effect on either the abundance of their prey species or the ease with which they can forage. So maybe they're hunting better close to a quiet road.
It's worth noting here that both this study and the study we were talking about previously, the dog detection study, were conducted here in northwestern California, not in the more uniform conifer forests of Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, and that's actually an important point, because we wouldn't expect to see a similar effect of roads on the nutritional status of owls in Washington and Oregon. And the reason for that is that the owls in Washington and Oregon specialize on flying squirrels, which are old growth specialists, whereas the primary prey species for the owls in California is the wood rat. And so wood rats have different habitat relationships. They're not as directly tied to the old growth forests as the flying squirrels are.
Yeah, and they like edge also. So these edge habitats, which is kind of what a road creates. So the effect on reproductive success on these owls was really remarkable, in the sense that as Lisa was saying, if it's a low noise road, then owls fledging nearest the low noise road had much, much higher reproductive success than owls fledging or nesting far away from roads. But if it was a high noise road, it was just the opposite. The owls nesting closest to the roads had the lowest reproductive success and did better further away. And one of the things that concerns us about that is if there's really good food near the roads, then owls are going to tend to want to roost nearest the roads, and that could make roads act like a population sink. So the owls come into the roads and they have their young, they nest there, and then if that road is a high noise road, then essentially these owls will have low success as a result. So it'll pull them into these areas where they may not realize it's going to have serious impacts on their reproductive success.
And you're listening to the Eco News Report on KHSU. I'm Scott Greeson, Executive Director of EPIC. I'm talking on the phone with Drs. Samuel Wasser and Lisa Hayward, both from the University of Washington Center for Conservation Biology. We're talking about some absolutely fascinating research into spotted owls and their responses to various kinds of stress, as well as efforts to detect them. So how would you describe the management implications of your results?
For me, it's pretty unambiguous that the roads or that the traffic exposure is having a significant negative effect on the owls. And we could actually, if we had more funding and we're going to continue the study, we could work that out into numbers on what kinds of impacts the roads will have on the population over time. But at this point, it's just clear that we had a limited sample size for the correlational component because we didn't have sound level meters on every single site. But even with that really small sample size, we had enormous power, enormous statistical significance. So that tells me that this is a factor that really needs to be contended with. And I would, using our data, I would suggest that the roads within 800 meters of an owl, a known owl rooster nest, need to be managed pretty carefully during the breeding season in order to keep the reproductive success high for the remaining pairs of spotted owls in our national forest.
I think I'd like to add just one thing to that, which is one of the nice things about this methodology is, you know, physiology it tends to be a very striking signal of what's going on because animals tend to try to maintain their body in homeostasis, so deviations from that homeostasis tends to be pretty conspicuous. And so one of the nice things about these tools is that we can come up with management suggestions on how to improve the conservation status of the owls and how to better manage the off-highway vehicles. If we continue to use these monitoring techniques once those guidelines have been put in place, we can actually measure fairly quickly how well they're working. And that's a really important strength of this methodology because so often we do these studies and people will come up with ways of trying to mitigate the problem and then they just implement them and they don't really do much to follow through to see how effective are they. And oftentimes it may take a very, very long period of time if they do look to see what's going on. Then all of a sudden they decide, well, it's not really working. But by being able to continue these measures right after you have implemented them, the mitigation acts, it actually provides you a way of more quickly telling is this working or not, and if it doesn't appear to be working, to essentially modify the types of mitigations that you're trying to do and see is that improving things. So in terms of really having a tool that allows you to do adaptive management, these tools are really superb. And the other thing that's really important about this is, you know, very often when managers are looking at these issues, the bottom line comes down to, is the animal's reproductive success being impacted? And one of the problems is that these disturbances, very rarely does a disturbance actually kill an animal. What it does is it increases their probability of dying. It, you know, creates an accumulating pressure on the owl or other species that gradually increases probability of dying. So when you're trying to look at the relationship between an environmental impact and reproductive outcome, which may occur a year later or so, so many other things have happened in the interim that trying to then say that this event actually caused this outcome becomes really difficult. But using these tools to measure the physiological response from the time of the impact all the way out really allows you to better tie the disturbance to the actual outcome and ultimately to the reproductive success outcome. And the same thing is true when you're trying to implement mitigations, because it's so important to be able to look early on to see, is this working or not, so that you don't be led astray and can make on-course corrections to really optimize the effect.
Thank you. That's really excellent. I think we're pretty much out of recording time. I want to see if I can get your response to one more point in, and that's the problem of the mom. So in your results, you've demonstrated stress responses from parent owls, basically. Very high stress responses, especially from the dads responsible for feeding their mates and offspring. But meanwhile, the mother owls, who seem already overburdened by multiple babies on the nest, show a stress response which seems to indicate nearly a collapse of their response system. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, that was one of the interesting results that emerged from the combination of the stress steroid with the thyroid hormone. We were able to find that the females that had the most young and the lowest thyroid hormone, so in other words, the highest, well, sort of the most stretched energetic budget, they actually responded in the opposite way that the rest of the owls in the population did. So most owls increased stress steroid in response to the motorcycle traffic, and these really taxed females decreased the stress steroids in response to motorcycles. And that's something that's sort of new to the literature, but it's only been seen in studies where animals are under really debilitating chronic stress. So what that indicates to us is that the females that don't have a lot of buffer in terms of their energy reserves, they're really suffering from this exposure to motorcycles. The females with the too young and not a lot of prey.
Yeah, because the stress response is very expensive for the animal, and so these guys are kind of at their limit, and it's almost as though they can't afford to launch a stress response. And it's interesting because you see a similar kind of a thing happen when birds are going through molt, because they're putting so much energy into growing new feathers that their whole stress response just shuts right down because they can't afford to launch one at that time.
But the implications for reproduction are pretty clear. If you've got a already stressed out mom, if her response to another, just one more increment of stress is essentially to shut down, that's going to make it difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, what that suggests to us is that a threshold has been crossed and the female no longer has the resources to cope with this additional challenge represented by the motorcycles.
Just one more quick thing.
Sure.
You have, and that's that since you're talking about sex differences, it's also was also really interesting in our study was the differences in impact of the motorcycles depending on when it occurred over the breeding season. In the early part of the breeding season, when they were nesting and the owls were still defending their territory and bringing food back to the female, and the female was pretty much just sitting on the nest, the impacts of the motorcycles were much, much more significant on the adult males than the adult females. And then later in the year, when the owls were being fledged, then the stress on the female started to get significant.
Well, thank you both very much. I really appreciate your time and patience.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, and best of luck, and hopefully we'll get you fully funded in the future.
All right. We'll hold you.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Bye.
So this has been the Eco News Report. My name's still Scott Greeson, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today were Drs. Samuel Wasser and Lisa Hayward, both from the University of Washington's Center for Conservation Biology. You can learn more about them and their conservation canine program at conservationbiology.net. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the Public Affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, the files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can also find EPIC, the organization I work for, at wildcalifornia.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.